In a matter of 1 week, not a day went by when a high-ranking official was not in Iran, which included figures like the Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the likes. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi will be making his presence coming up fresh from his appearance at the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. This is important, since Iran has become a permanent member of this organization. And the reason for this importance is, unlike claims made by the U.S. and the West, Iran is an important fixture on the world stage.
In recent years, political and economic multilateralism has come under serious threat. The U.S. government is trying to impose its demands and domestic law on the international system and sovereign countries through outright bullying and coercion. Washington's unilateralism is undoubtedly aimed at hampering independent countries' progress.
The SCO is the world's largest regional organization, covering approximately 60% of the area of Eurasia, 40% of the world population, and more than 30% of the global GDP. Yet a recent incident took place that did not get much coverage, but it displayed how the Islamic Republic has peaceful intentions when it comes to conflicts and can act as a mediator. It had to do with the Ukraine conflict. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amiri Abdollahian, delivered a European peace initiative on Ukraine to Russia, in which Iran said it had received the proposal from an anonymous European leader. This squarely pits Iran's peaceful intentions against the U.S. warmongering policy when it comes to Ukraine. So, when Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi takes the podium, representing Iran and his peaceful intentions, like its peaceful nuclear program, it is showing how Iran deserves the respect that it is entitled to, not the sanctions and embargoes imposed by the West and the U.S.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new version of the 2025-2030 dietary guidelines published by the US government doesn't mention food's role in the climate crisis at all. Climate groups say this is an abdication of responsibility, with Americans feeling the effects of a warming planet more than ever. We'll prepare for you an article written by Marina Bolotnikova. The piece is titled, How U.S. Government Diet Guidelines Ignore the Climate Crisis. To keep the climate habitable, most scientists agree that switching to renewable energy alone isn't enough. Americans also need to change the way they eat. Environmental and public health advocates are pushing a new strategy to help get there, including climate breakdown in the official U.S. dietary guidelines, which shape what goes into billions of meals eaten across the country every year. Every 5 years, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services jointly publish a new version of the guidelines. They formed the basis for the public-facing eating guide, My Plate, formerly My Pyramid, as well as many government-backed meal programs such as National School Lunch. Historically, these guidelines have narrowly focused on human nutrition, but some are now saying they should be expanded to incorporate climate considerations as well. The current 150-page edition for 2020 through to 2025 doesn't mention food's role in the climate crisis at all. Climate groups say this is an abdication of responsibility, with Americans feeling the effects of a warming planet more than ever. The recently passed Inflation Reduction Act The so-called most significant climate legislation in U.S. history does very little to address the food system. Jesse Silverman, a senior policy associate for the Center for Science in the Public Interest, said, "Climate change poses a multitude of threats to human health and nutrition security. We cannot extricate these things from each other." Her group and 39 others, including the Union of Concerned Scientists and the American Academy of Pediatrics, in May, wrote a letter urging the U.S. government to include sustainability in the 2025-2030 dietary guidelines, which are now in development. A sustainability component would encourage Americans to eat less meat and dairy products, which have a significant higher climate impact than nutritionally comparable plant-based foods. Another signatory to the letter, Mark Rifkin, senior food and agriculture policy specialist for the Center for Biological Diversity, said, "It will be virtually impossible to even meet the 2 degrees Celsius limit in global temperature change without incorporating substantial reductions in beef intake." Walter Willett, a professor at Harvard University's School of Public Health, said the current guidelines advise Americans to eat far more animal products than is sustainable. The primary dietary chart recommends 26 ounces of protein from meat, poultry, and eggs a week, compared with just 5 ounces from plant-based foods, although there are alternative charts that show how vegetarians can get the same nutrients without meat. He said they also still basically say 3 servings of dairy products a day, which is actually really radical because our current consumption is 1.6 servings a day, adding, "To just recommend 3 servings of dairy products and say nothing about the environmental consequences if people really did that is just completely irresponsible." Because most Americans are deficient in fiber and fruits and vegetables, not animal products, Mark Rifkin, a dietitian, said, "Climate-focused guidance would line up with what the public needs nutritionally." He said it would also help address other problems that stem from the meat-heavy U.S. food system, including risk of future pandemics, food security, and pollution from concentrated animal feeding operations, which disproportionately affect communities of color. A proposed list of questions released in April for the scientific panel that advises the guidelines didn't include sustainability. That worries advocates, but they say it's still early. Janet DeJesus, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services staff lead on the guidelines, said sustainability could still be included. DeJesus said, "We're not saying that it's not going to be in the dietary guidelines. We're not saying that at all." She added, "It's a high priority for the Health and Human Services leadership to address climate change." According to a United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization FAO report, countries including Germany, Brazil, Sweden and Qatar have addressed sustainability in their dietary guidelines. Canada's Food Guide advises choosing plant-based foods more often for the environment. Vox reported recently Germany has cut its per capita meat consumption by 12% since 2011, and its Minister of Food and Agriculture has recently prioritized a shift towards more plant-based eating. Advocates say a change in the U.S. dietary guidelines could have a similar influence. Jesse Silverman says, "The guidelines are much more impactful than I think a lot of people realize. Federal food aid programs have to comply with the guidelines, shaping how millions of people eat. For instance, the National School Lunch and National School Breakfast programs claim they served more than 7 billion meals a year to tens of millions of children before the COVID-19 pandemic. The guidelines also influence cafeteria foods served in government buildings, hospitals and other institutions, and are used in nutrition education programs. According to a recent paper in Communications, Earth and Environment, national school lunches' reach makes it uniquely positioned to affect the dietary patterns of American children and adolescents and could aid in addressing the environmental impacts of food systems. Meat contributes disproportionately to school meals' impact on the climate, as well as land and water use. Because U.S. government programs and other large institutions claim they serve so many meals, sustainability advocates in recent years have focused on trying to influence their food buying decisions. California earlier this year allowed $100 million to help schools serve more plant-based meals. This isn't the first time the environment has been at issue in the nation's dietary guidelines. In 2015, a panel of nutrition experts that advised the 2015 through to 2020 guidelines addressed sustainability in its scientific report. The panel wrote, "In general, a dietary pattern that is higher in plant-based foods such as vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and lower in animal-based foods is more healthy, and it should be promoted, and is associated with lesser environmental impact." But after outcry from the meat industry and U.S. Republican lawmakers, the recommendation to eat more plants was dropped from the final guidelines. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal at the time, the U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said sustainability was outside the purview of the dietary guidelines and compared the scientific committee to his granddaughter, whose colors outside of the lines. Bob Martin of the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future said about Tom Vilsack's comments, "It's really condescending stuff. The people involved in this were highly qualified." Agribusiness has a long history of influence over the dietary guidelines, and it will undoubtedly be a factor this time around as well. The meat and dairy industries spent $49.5 million on political contributions in 2020 and another $15.9 million lobbying the federal government. Food industry groups also routinely report lobbying on federal nutrition policy. According to federal lobbying records, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association between 2014 and 2016 spent more than $303,000 lobbying to keep beef in the dietary guidelines. Several industry groups, including the North American Meat Institute, the National Dairy Foods Association, and the National Turkey Federation, have already weighed in on the process for the 2025 through to 2030 guidance. The National Pork Producers Council wrote in a public comment in May, "While an important topic, sustainability is outside of the scope of the dietary guidelines." Jesse Silverman of the Center for Science and the Public Interest said, "Even though environmental advocates face an uphill battle, a lot has changed since the failed 2015 effort to incorporate sustainability." She added, "I think the public pressure to have concrete policies to address climate change has grown a lot in the years since then."
Economic Divide.
The fall of the dollar is gaining momentum. The Ukraine conflict has speeded up that process, especially since China and Russia have said that they would trade their oil in their own currencies. Given that the infrastructure is in place for the financial transactions, and U.S.'s rocky economic state. Will the dollar demise occur sooner rather than later? Hi, I'm Kavit Avayi. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has said de-dollarization is inevitable. Is it? We will question that. Also, China and Russia accelerating their moves towards that. One of the consequences, a positive one for them, minimizing U.S. sanctions impacts. Also, de-dollarization contagion. The BRICS countries, they got together, their 14th session, and they said, we're going to have a new reserve currency. Also, strengthening bilateral trade in their national currencies, another move towards de-dollarization. And finally, a look at central bank reserves reducing dollars, exchanging to the yuan. Good news for China. That shows that the dollar is losing value. Saudi Arabia and Israel following suit.
The de-dollarization trend, which was in the making for years prior to the Ukraine war, has gained momentum following the latest crisis. Russia and China have decided to ditch the dollar in their bilateral trade and business ties. Beijing and Moscow have initiated programs and signed de-dollarization agreements to protect and shield their economies from U.S. governments. By 2020, less than half of bilateral trade transactions between these two countries were in dollars. This has gained pace following the recent tensions. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has recently said that the process of de-dollarization of the global economy is inevitable. Other countries are also joining the trend. Venezuela, Turkey, Pakistan, and Iran are also joining the process.
The dollar and the online reaction to what the Russian president has said, overall looking at how de-dollarization is inevitable. Responses are varied, but many, as opposed to before, are pointing to the direction of the dollar's value decreasing and for it not to have that international standing or the superior standing as it has been interpreted before. Take a look at our first post here, a U.S. CBDC currency that's digital in nature is being examined to help the U.S. dollar's international standing. Translation, de-dollarization, and losing the world reserve currency status. Got some gold or silver?
Are examining whether a U.S. central bank digital currency would improve upon what is an already safe and efficient domestic payment system. As our white paper on this topic notes, a U.S. CBDC could also potentially help maintain the dollar's international standing.
Next, China and Russia moving to disrupt the dollar's dominance in oil markets, where it goes on to say, in this particular entry, Russia and China are making moves to dethrone the U.S. dollar in global oil markets. Russian and Chinese hydrocarbon giants Gazprom and China National Petroleum Corporation have agreed to switch payments for gas supplies to rubles. Then it elaborates more. China has long regarded the position of the renminbi, or the yuan, in the global league table of currencies as being a reflection of its own geopolitical and economic importance on the world stage. Okay, Russian companies is our next post saying that the shift to the yuan is happening as flight from dollar accelerates. Then, are you ready for the Great Reset? This was something that makes very much big news when it was announced because it is something that is a work in progress. And the WEF, or the World Economic Forum, said America's dominance is over. By the year 2030, we will have a handful of global powers. And finally, our next online post, the U.S. dollar's global standing as a top reserve currency has lost ground to China's yuan and others. So that's what we're looking at in terms of online posts, many of them pointing to the direction of the dollar's dominance nearing or reaching or accelerating towards its end. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. First up, we have Jayanth Tharapal joining us. He's the editor of the Oriental Despot website. He also has written a piece called How Declining Currency Hegemony Leads to War. All right, welcome to the program, Jayanth Tharapal, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. Let me start with that in terms of what he has said. De-dollarization is inevitable. Now, we've heard that before, and we've heard many who have said that the dollar's international standing is not as high as it used to be. What are the reasons behind that? Are we looking at the Ukraine conflict maybe contributing to this? Because this is a stance that has happened before. How do you see the dollar standing right now?
Well, thank you for the question, Kaveh. Look, the sanctions on Russia are actually unprecedented in that the targeted currencies, the targeted country's currency is actually strengthened. This has never really happened before. Usually what happens is that the United States imposes sanctions on a country and the targeted country experiences a rapid depreciation of its own currency. But this hasn't happened with Russia, and that's because Europe needs Russian energy. Turns out that the German economy, you know, worth about $1 trillion, or the European economy worth about $1 trillion, was ultimately sitting on a foundation of something like $40 billion worth of Russian energy imports. That's how important Russia is. So without those energy imports, Europe cannot produce the high value-added manufactured goods that it's known for and that backs the value of its currency. So BRICS has expanded its trade with Russia as well, and that's the other reason why the Russian currency hasn't depreciated too much. And over the past, you know, if we look at the long term, over the past 6 years, the composition of foreign exchange reserves data that you get from the IMF shows that US dollar reserves are actually falling. So in 2016, US dollar reserves were 65% of global central bank balance sheets. Now it's 58%, which is doesn't seem like much, but in the grand scheme of things, it's actually quite big, especially when you consider that 20, 30 years ago, it used to be about 80%.
Indeed. Let's find out what our guest thinks about what our guest there talked about the dollar and its dominance. Bradley Blankenship joins us. He's a Prague-based American journalist. He is also a political analyst and a freelance reporter. Well, Bradley, welcome. Taking a look at what our guest there said in terms of the standing of the dollar, he talked about Russia. Russia is part of the BRICS summit. I'm sorry, BRICS grouping of countries, of which the summit was just held, the 14th one. Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa are the members. And the Russian president announced about this intention to develop a new international currency, a reserve currency, to target the U.S. dollar status. Is that going to work? Because we're looking at a grouping of countries, and perhaps this is something that may spread to other countries.
Yeah, that's right. So the leaders talked about creating a basket of their currencies to use in international transactions instead of the dollar. And I think because, you know, if you look at how important these countries are, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and then, of course, you have other countries like Argentina now wanting to join BRICS. Maybe Saudi Arabia is going to join BRICS. You know, this represents a real serious challenge, like a serious alternative to the dollar, because these are very important countries. And I think that these countries will become even more important. The thing is that the global south is going to be in the next few decades the hub of global development. This is going to, you're going to see the most GDP growth in these countries. It's going to be you know, the best investment opportunity. And so I think that these currencies will be more valuable and more lucrative to trade in. And certainly, as I said before, how the US dollar was the lubricant of the global economy, I think you'll see that these currencies will be even more important as there's more investment in these countries. And then, of course, more cooperation between them.
It's time now for our Info News section of the program. This is where we review news from around the world with an economic flavor. First up, we take a look at a summit by the name of SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, in which Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, called on SCO to confront U.S. unilateralism through new approaches, something he said at this summit. Now, one of the solutions, sustainable trade between the SCO members, through joint development of infrastructure such as financial transactions. Note, financial transactions, very important because they would like to sway away from the dollar, which is the topic of our program. All right, next up, there's been a seizure by Germany. What has occurred? Well, the country has seized control of Russian oil refineries, and that's big news for Germany in a sense, but yet the confrontation escalates with Russia. The move of Germany is aimed at ensuring the operation of three local Rosneft facilities after service providers allegedly refused to work with the Russian company. Next up, U.S. targeting Russia, nothing new there, but this target is about banks using Russian payment systems. How has it done that? Well, Russian banks have issued more than 120 million Mir cards. So the cards that it has issued based on the Mir system, the financial system that Russia uses in any shape or form for the U.S. is obviously off limits for anybody using that. So the U.S. is after any entity, organization, corporation, etc., that is using Russia in any shape or form. And finally, taking a look at the next piece of news is something that we perhaps are a bit surprised, but yet it shouldn't be. That's about how there has been a new pipeline that is now going to be executed, in which Moscow has unveiled this new gas pipeline, which is going to be going to China. It's called the Soyuz Vostok in terms of the project itself, and it is expected to deliver 50 billion cubic meters of natural gas annually. The question is, whatever happened to the other pipeline that goes to Europe, for example? What's going to happen to that? Well, that's a question that only time will tell. Well, those were some of the stories that we thought were important for this past week. It's time now for an in-depth section of the program. The standing of the U.S. dollar may be something that has been somewhat or more or less stable throughout the years and even decades. But things like the Ukraine conflict have pushed that and accelerated its standing on the declining side. That's what we're going to try to reveal to you in this in-depth section. First, the U.S. dollar's global standing. Well, it was the top reserve currency. However, it has lost ground. It has lost ground to, for example, the Chinese yuan. The currency basket of the IMF actually has five currencies, but the Chinese yuan is coming out pretty strong these days. However, we're still looking at a ways to go because you also have the euro trailing behind the dollar. But the dollar standing is gradually coming down and decreasing. Next up, our focus is on central banks. Now, this is very important in terms of the central bank's reserves in dollars. Now, that is down to 59%. Now, it used to be above 65%. According to one of our guests in this program, it was at around 80% at some point. But that has gone down. Why has it gone down? One particular instant changed all of that. And that was when the U.S. reached out and confiscated the Russian dollar reserve currency held at central banks, which made other countries think twice about holding reserves actually in dollars. One of them, the Israeli Central Bank. For example, when you take a look at U.S.'s staunchest ally, Israel, well, it has actually added the Chinese yuan for the first time, okay? This is the first time ever, while cutting its dollar holdings. This is the biggest currency reshuffle that has happened in at least a decade. So there, it shows you how the dollar's standing, or value, I should say, has fallen. Then comes the issue of oil trade in dollars. Of course, when we talk about oil, we have to talk about Saudi Arabia. Yes, Saudi Arabia is considering trading oil in yuan. That could be going on without them wanting this to be leaked out. Of course, that'd be kind of tough. But at this point, it is definitely on the table and in Saudi Arabia's cards for it to trade oil in the yuan. Keep in mind on the side note that China and Russia are actually going to go ahead with that. Actually, it's not a side note. It's coming up next in terms of our look at the dollar's demise, in a sense. China and Russia, to disrupt this dollar dominance. How are they doing that? Well, they're going to do it in the oil markets, obviously. And the way they've gone forward to do that, they've agreed to switch payments for gas supplies to rubles. China's renminbi is also reflective of Chinese geopolitical importance because China also wants its currency, the renminbi, or the yuan, as it is said, to gain value throughout this whole process. So those were some of the angles in this in-depth look to show how the dollar is decreasing in its dominance or in its value, in a sense. Well, let's bring in have our guests rejoin us on this in this particular question. First, we have Jayanth Tharapal, who runs the Oriental Despot website, joining us. He also is the author of How Declining Currency Hegemony Leads to War. Well, Jayanth Tharapal, welcome back. Countries holding foreign currencies in reserve is what my focus is here. And we're looking at how Russia's $640 billion U.S. dollars was actually confiscated by the U.S. in terms of the sanctions imposed. And that obviously put a lot of countries doubt into holding the dollar in U.S. currencies, like Saudi Arabia, who's thinking of selling oil in the yuan, and also Israel, which for the first time cut its dollar holdings in the biggest currency reshuffle. What does this show when two of U.S.'s closest allies are doing this?
Well, it's not a surprise that Israel would sell off its dollars and buy some Chinese yuan or renminbi, as it's called. And that's because Israel has always been less loyal to the United States than the United States has been to Israel. Israel is a country that has in the past sold U.S. military secrets directly to China. So holding their currency is not that egregious an affront to the United States compared to what they've done in the past. As for Saudi Arabia, this is a big deal. It's a very big deal. Sometime in the past 10, 12 years, I can't remember, China became a bigger importer of Saudi oil than Western countries combined. And so this is such a major problem for the United States is because the oil that Saudi Arabia exports to world markets is what upholds the value of the US dollar because of the petrodollar system. Saudi Arabia, as a part of OPEC, since 1975, has priced oil in dollars. Now it's negotiating with China to price its oil in yuan. And so if Saudi Arabia moves ahead with these plans, then it's going to mean that countries around the world are going to be looking towards their exchange rate with the Chinese yuan in order to import the oil that they need from Saudi Arabia. And this is going to reduce the demand for U.S. dollars, which means more inflation for the U.S.
All right, very well. Bradley Blankenship rejoins us now. Bradley Blankenship is the Prague-based American journalist and political analyst and freelance reporter. Bradley, welcome back. Taking a look at the Russian President Vladimir Putin, we said this before in the program about how he has said that the process of de-dollarization is actually inevitable. So when he talks that way, he has said that before, along with many other analysts, financial advisors, investment bankers, etc., at least the camp that exists out there in terms of how de-dollarization is inevitable. How true do you think that is? I mean, we're looking at how one of the things that Washington is being critiqued about is how it's bullying other countries, whether it's through sanctions or its foreign policy. I mean, do you think this dollar de-dollarization is actually in motion, maybe even faster?
So I think that the current economic situation opens up a very interesting opportunity for de-dollarization. And that's particularly because I think that the situation that we have now is very similar to the one that we had in the 1970s, where there was this mix of inflation and recession that's called stagflation. So this is when the economy is contracting and then real wages are declining through inflation. And the solution to this problem at the time was neoliberal capitalism, globalization. And this was, you know, the Chinese jumped on board with this. And essentially, what happened was America was bailed out by investments in the global south, namely China. And now that we're having basically the same situation again, the United States is not investing in the global south, but China, Russia, other countries are. And now you see more of a multipolar world order coming out of this. The U.S. dollar during the previous period, the 1970s and 1980s, was the lubricant that created the situation that was globalization. But now the U.S. dollar is kind of a political weapon. It's a blockade against this. It's against globalization. And in my opinion, and I think probably most economists would agree, is that the process of globalization cannot be reversed. It has already happened. It's a permanent feature of the economy. And so essentially the conclusion is that the U.S. dollar is proving itself to be against globalization. And that's why I think that the present time, with all of the inflationary pressures, the recessions that we see around the world, now is a very opportune time for the U.S. dollar to be dethroned.
BRICS countries, which include BRICS Summit in Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, have decided to develop a new international reserve currency. The move is intended to target the U.S. dollar status as the world's premier currency.
There are other factors at play as well. We're shifting from a banking settlement system to a digital settlement system. This will also change how payments are made, and it will take away the central role of the U.S. dollar. And this will change the nature of the global settlements or monetary system.
Now appears that the U.S. dollar will still be a global currency, but will lose its supremacy as a trading currency. That will erode the U.S. ability to use the dollar as a bargaining tool.
Ever since the war erupted in Ukraine, global geostrategic and geopolitical alliances have reshaped international politics. countries are beginning to find new partners and join new alliances. The war prompted the West to impose sanctions on Russia, and Moscow has intoned and launched an energy war on the U.S. and its allies. Amid these raptures, one key question has dominated political debates about the future of global economy, the fate of the U.S. dollar in global trade. A little bit of historical outlook is helpful here. Based on Bretton Woods Agreement signed in 1994, gold was the basis for the U.S. dollar, and other currencies were pegged to the U.S. dollar's value. The Bretton Woods Agreement was also created to create two important organizations. It led to these two important organizations, actually, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank. But by the 1970s, President Richard Nixon announced an end to the agreement, practically terminating Washington's commitment to exchange gold for U.S. currency. That gave the United States a huge advantage. Washington could now use its own currency as the global currency without having to peg it against the value of gold. That paved the way for the global dominance of the U.S. dollar. The United States could now print money to boost its own economy at the expense of other countries. But things have begun to change. High inflation rates in the United States have weakened the U.S. dollar. Furthermore, Washington's weaponization of its currency has prompted other countries to move away from the U.S. dollar.
I spoke to you about the national energy crisis and our policy for meeting it. Tonight, I want to talk with you again.
That does it for this segment of the program. Please send us any comments or thoughts you have on whether it was useful or not.
When it comes to the subject of the dollar, whether it's a demise conversation that's being held, or whether the fall of the dollar in terms of its value is being discussed, there's one thing for sure. The geopolitics of the world have changed. We're looking at Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, countries that hold almost half of the world's oil reserves. These countries in one camp, and the thought of Saudi Arabia says they are contemplating trading oil in the yuan, for example, is going to definitely have the dollar take a hit. As to how much that will increase the fall of the dollar, only time will tell. It will happen sooner than later. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. Questions, comments, suggestions, or critiques, do let us know. From me, Kaveh Tagli, and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
The Western world claims to practice freedom of expression, while it is proved that this motto is just a lie. When it comes to Palestinians and the issue of resistance, freedom of expression is widely restricted. This is evidently seen today by the actions of Facebook and Instagram in violating the rights of Palestinians during the Gaza war. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the second part. According to Intercept, Facebook and Instagram's speech policies harmful fundamental human rights of Palestinian users during a conflagration that saw heavy Israeli regime attacks on the Gaza Strip last May, according to a study commissioned by the social media site's parent company Meta. Meta's actions in May 2021 appear to have had an adverse human rights impact on the rights of Palestinian users to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, political participation, and non-discrimination, and therefore on the ability of Palestinians to share information and insights about their experiences as they occurred, says the long-awaited report which was obtained by The Intercept in advance of its publication. Commissioned by Meta last year and conducted by the independent consultancy Business for Social Responsibility, or BSR, the report focuses on the company's censorship practices and allegations of bias during bouts of violence against Palestinian people by the Zionist regime forces last spring. Following protests over the forcible eviction of Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, Israeli regime police cracked down on protesters in the West Bank and launched military airstrikes against Gaza that injured thousands of Palestinians, killing 256, including 66 children, according to the United Nations. Many Palestinians attempting to document and protest the violence using Facebook and Instagram found their post spontaneously disappeared without recourse, a phenomenon the BSR inquiry attempts to explain. Last month, over a dozen civil society and human rights groups wrote an open letter protesting Meta's delay in releasing the report, which the company had originally pledged to release in the first quarter of the year. While BSR credits Meta for taking steps to improve its policies, it further blames a lack of oversight at Meta that allowed content policy errors with significant consequences to occur. Though BSR is clear in stating that Meta harms Palestinian rights with censorship apparatus, it alone has constructed the report absolves Meta of intentional bias. Rather, BSR points to what it calls unintentional bias, instances where Meta policy and practice combined with broader external dynamics does lead to different human rights impacts on Palestinian and Arabic-speaking users, a nod to the fact that these systematic flaws are by no means limited to the events of May 2021. Meta responded to the BSR report in a document to be circulated along with the findings. Meta did not respond to Intercept's request for comment about the report by publication time. In a footnote in the response, which was also obtained by The Intercept, the company wrote, "Meta's publication of this response should not be construed as an admission, agreement with, or acceptance of any of the findings, conclusions, opinions, or viewpoints identified by BSR, nor should the implementation of any suggested reforms be taken as admission of wrongdoing." According to the findings of BSR's report, Meta deleted Arabic content relating to the violence at a far greater rate than Hebrew language posts, confirming long-running complaints of disparate speech enforcement in the Palestinian conflict. The disparity, the report found, was perpetuated among posts reviewed both by human employees and automated software. The data reviewed indicated that Arabic content had greater over-enforcement, for example, erroneously removing Palestinian voice on a per-user basis, the report says. Data reviewed by BSR also showed that proactive detection rates of potentially violating Arabic content were significantly higher than proactive detection rates of potentially violating Hebrew content. BSR attributed the vastly differing treatment of Palestinian posts to the same systematic problems rights groups, whistleblowers, and researchers have all blamed for the company's past humanitarian failures, a dismal lack of expertise. Meta, a company with over $24 billion in cash reserves, lacks staff who understand other cultures, languages, and histories, and is using faulty algorithmic technology to govern speech around the world, the BSR report claimed. Not only do Palestinian users face an algorithmic screening that Israeli regime users do not, an Arabic hostile speech classifier that uses machine learning to flag potential policy violations and has no Hebrew equivalent, the report notes that the Arabic system also doesn't work well. Arabic classifiers are likely less accurate for Palestinian Arabic than other dialects, both because the dialect is less common and because the training data, which is based on assessments of human reviewers, likely reproduces the errors of human reviewers due to lack of linguistic and cultural competence, it claimed. Human employees appear to have exacerbated the lopsided effects of Meta's speech policing algorithms. Potentially violating Arabic content may not have been routed to content reviewers who speak or understand the specific dialect of the content, the report says. It also notes that Meta didn't have enough Arabic and Hebrew-speaking staff on the hand to manage the spike in posts. Beyond Meta's failures in triaging posts about Sheikh Jarrah, BSR also points to the company's Dangerous Individuals and Organizations policy, referred to as DOI in the report, a roster of thousands of people and groups that Meta's billions of users cannot praise, support, or represent. The full list obtained and published by The Intercept last year showed that the policy focuses mostly on Muslim and West Asia entities, which critics described as a recipe for glaring ethnic and religious bias. Meta claims that it's legally compelled to censor mention of groups designated by the U.S. regime, but legal scholars have disputed the company's interpretation of federal anti-terrorism laws. Following The Intercept's report on the list, the Brennan Center for Justice called the company's claims of legal obligation a fiction.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyya on August 30th, 2022. Another great achievement you've made is that this government has refrained from blaming others and making excuses. And it has accepted responsibility for the actions it has taken. During this time, we haven't heard any government official say, they won't let us do anything, we don't have any authority or such and such is out of our hand. We haven't heard these things from you. Accepting responsibility for your actions is truly important. You say, we are here, we need to get the job done, and we will get the job done. This is a very positive, important point. Another important point is that good approaches are being taken in the fields of foreign policy and culture. Now, these approaches, especially in the cultural fields, will take time to be implemented. But there are positive approaches. They need to be followed up. They are another of your accomplishments. The slogans of the revolution have gained emphasis as have the slogans of Islam. Slogans such as seeking justice, avoiding luxuries, supporting the oppressed, and standing against arrogance. These are the main slogans of the revolution. These matters have been emphasized and been clearer in people's speech, and this is a great thing. Continue with it.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Try to continue with these accomplishments. I shall talk about these more when I am making my recommendations. In any case, consistent work is needed in all fields. This was about the first part, your achievements. As for my recommendations, I have a few suggestions. My first word of advice, which I have given to most of the governments that have been formed in recent years, is that first of all, you should be grateful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for blessing you with the opportunity to serve people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Rome's suburban Tiburtino Terzo Quarter is once again home to a new edition of the Palestine Festival, a four-day initiative organized by the Palestinian Association of Rome and Lazio Region and the Palestinian Youth Association, created by Palestinian expat Youssef Salman with the aim to foster intercultural understanding and promoting Palestinian culture in the Italian capital. This year's edition of the festival also has a focus on Palestine and Latin America.
Many Latin American countries have been supporting the Palestinian cause. That's what I told to the people who attended the meeting this evening. I also told them about our President Abbas being in New York to discuss a two-state solution. But when will Israel sit at the negotiation table?
A number of Latin American heads of state came out and spoke loudly, proclaiming the rights of the Palestinians and denouncing the Israeli persecution against them at the UN over the past days. At Rome's Palestine Festival, diplomats from the Bolivian, Cuban, and Venezuelan embassies reiterated their support for the cause of Palestinian people in order to restore their legitimate rights. A commemoration of Shirin Abu Akleh was held during a panel on the dreadful living conditions of Palestinian journalists in the occupied territories. Recently, a new forensic analysis proved that the Israeli sniper who killed her could see that Shirin was a journalist before firing the bullet.
In the West Bank, journalists are shot, wounded, or arrested. In the Gaza Strip, there is no internet, no power. We cannot work. Israel simply doesn't want us to do our job. 55 Palestinian journalists have been killed by the Israeli forces in about 20 years. In regards to Shirin, Israeli soldiers knew full well she was a journalist when they killed her. It was a warning sent to all of us journalists in Palestine.
The Palestine Festival will continue on Saturday with an initiative commemorating the Sabra and Shatila massacre and a conference on Italy's and the EU's political stance on the plight of the Palestinians. The festival will end on Sunday. Max Civili, Rome.
It's the third time since Friday that Iranians assemble en masse to call the nation for peace. This gathering is in fact a response to days of nationwide street violence and riots that erupted in Iran following the death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian woman who died on September 16th, days after she was taken into a police station. The demonstrators here say while they sympathize with Mahsa's death, they don't want the violent protests to go on.
We are too waiting for the investigation to shed light on Mahsa's death. We are all saddened by her death. But unfortunately, some people are committing vandalism in the name of Mahsa. They're desecrating our sanctities in her name.
It's not about Ms. Amini. Those people who have violated law and order have used Mahsa's death as an excuse to incite unrest in our country. They have destroyed public properties and burned our flag, which represents our identity.
Police have rejected claims that Mahsa Amini was mistreated, saying no physical contact happened between officers and Amini. Now, violent protests and acts of vandalism come while Iranian authorities have given assurances that a thorough investigation is underway into her death. Here, people describe the rioters as foreign-backed elements who are exploiting the death of Mahsa Amini to instigate chaos and wreak havoc across the country.
I believe Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the U.S. are trying to use the issue of Mahsa Amini through their media propaganda to sow divisions among Iranians and deal a blow to the Islamic Republic. But they will never achieve their goals because our nation will stay united.
22-year-old Mahsa was an Iranian Kurd from the city of Saqqez in Kurdistan province. On September 13th, she was on a trip to Tehran with her family when she was taken by police. Police have released the CCTV footage showing Mahsa suddenly collapsing on the ground and then later being brought to an ambulance.
People here say they're all grieved for Mahsa's unfortunate fate. And they say the issue should not divide Iranians and harm national security. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinians rallied in Gaza following the Friday prayer to condemn Israeli violations against Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. Protesters condemned the Israeli provocative measures vowing to protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa. In recent days, Israeli regime forces have increased their presence near Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, taking advantage of Jewish holidays. Dozens of Jewish settlers were also allowed to storm the Holy Shrine and perform religious rituals. Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque, emphasizing that any provocative move against the sacred site will only infuriate Palestinians.
The Zionist criminal enemy is playing with fire and gunpowder that will only explode in its face. The enemy must not forget the sword of Al-Quds battle. If the Zionists continue to desecrate Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, we will wage bigger battles against them.
Palestinian officials accused Arab regimes who normalized ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against Al-Quds.
Those Arab and Islamic countries who normalize their ties with the Zionist enemy are encouraging it to violate and desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. Those countries have lost their moral compass and must correct their mistakes before it's too late.
Protesters slammed British Prime Minister Liz Truss for promising Israeli regime Prime Minister